This is Sharon Christofiak. I'm in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I'm guest hosting for Paul today. We're going to be having Andy Streifel from the University of Minnesota, monitoring for environmental management. And just for those of you that haven't heard, I've known Andy for maybe almost 15 years now, and he is just an excellent presenter. If anybody was online for his first presentation this year, you know what to expect. Great information, great slides, great pictures, and he's wonderful about helping if you have any questions afterwards. I won't go into all of Andy's background, but he is just an international treasure for everybody who knows him. So with that, let me remind everybody, you can either put your phones on mute or hit star 6. I will also be putting the audience on mute so that if you have anything else, you have to answer a page, or if anybody comes in, you won't be heard over the rest of the bridge line. And if everybody's ready, I'll turn it over to Andy.
Wow, thank you, Sharon. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here. It's a great opportunity to get to speak to so many people from my office. My goodness, it's great. You see in front of you my title slide. You see that I'm an hospital environment specialist, and I've worked in these 5 million square feet, those of you who think that way, of academic health center for the last 35 years, and have had the great privilege of taking care of patients that I feel a lot of empathy for, and really tried to help us understand what it was about the environment that might be of concern. And, of course, that is not totally my credit. We began sampling in these buildings in about 1960 and have continued that program through me up till the present. So we do a lot of environmental monitoring, and we will be referring today to the Environmental Infection Control document that came out June 6, 2003, and I will not spend a lot of time with certain slides, knowing that you can reference them on your own, but they are a helpful a compilation of information when we get to them. Second slide, again, deals with a concern for validation. We want to validate sanitation, and we do this often in food preparation surfaces. Of course, we do that mostly visually, but yet we know the impacts of what can happen when we have foodborne illness and the number of people that it can affect. And we have seen this in my facility with the immune-compromised patients. We also have mechanical issues as it relates to our ventilation systems, and we'll discuss some of the parameters that are associated with them, along with the contamination levels that we should expect for air and water, and to a certain extent, fomites. It's very difficult to deal with them because there are so many of them. They're more than us, but we will discuss some of the issues as it relates especially to mold contamination. And then we certainly want to prevent. Infection control is a prevention strategy, and certainly water damage management is key in dealing with issues in Minnesota, because we have a lot of water, and some of it comes down very fast, as some of you know in your own climates, and we do need to prepare for that. What do we monitor? The next slide discusses, or at least begins to address, some of the issues related to air and surfaces, as well as water. But we really want to focus today on ventilation parameters, because they're the prevention aspect. We don't prevent infections by sampling for microbes. We might have an idea what's there. We can improve the sanitation based on that. But when we're dealing with air quality and airborne spread type things, we certainly want to make our ventilation optimal for its purposes, and that requires following those parameters. And, of course, my forte seems to be construction and maintenance practice, and one of the things we see almost every building, including the one I live in, is water damage. And we want a response plan. We want people to react appropriately when they find mold and clean it up. And as we construct or deconstruct our buildings, in the case of renovation, we do need to be very mindful of the fact that all buildings leak, and all buildings have mold in it somewhere that, when disrupted, can become a problem for especially patients or people who have allergic tendencies. Environmental sampling really is not a clinical microbiology. Sampling is supported. When we do sampling, we want it supported by an epidemiological assessment. We need to hear from infection control when we have something weird going on that we want to look at. And the CDC says that random undirected sampling is not recommended. We have sampled tens of thousands of times in my building. We use our information. We hope to help you better understand, as you will see very shortly, how to look at the data and then how to interpret it. Because whenever you sample, you certainly need a protocol for sampling. You certainly need the analysis and an action based on the interpretation of results. So before you imbibe in any kind of sampling for whatever purposes, you should figure out how you want to interpret your data beforehand. And we'll give you some of those kinds of clues. When to sample, of course, the most important sampling in my mind is before you occupy. This is baseline data. This is the information that you will use in the future to judge how clean or how well ventilated your environment will be. It requires comparison. If you only sample in the operating rooms, for example, you don't know how the rest of the building is performing, and the numbers you get might be artificially low because you live by the ocean, or it's in the middle of winter, or you just have no way of knowing one area from the other. So we'll discuss how we compare. Disease outbreak, of course, is what we're really concerned about, and of course, environmental parameters with the emphasis on source detection is what we want to do through surface and air content, especially for fungi, which truly are environmental microbes, even though some of our present-day VRE and MRSA as well as C. diff come from patients and may contaminate the environment. The fungi are truly environmental and not as generally associated or not associated with patients. Surface samples certainly do help us find those aerosols, and we do need to look for them from time to time. But when we look at the validation of ventilation, especially pressure controls the way air moves, and we want to keep whatever a microbe might be, a problematic microbe, away, especially if it's airborne spread, away from the susceptible host, be it the employee or the patient. Air exchanges are needed for purifying. It's the solution to pollution is dilution, and we certainly utilize clean air to do that. Non-viable particles can be used to assess filtration efficacy, but unfortunately, medical staff better understand viable counts, those of which are culturable, which we can see. The next slide is a summary slide from the CDC guidelines for environmental infection control, and are used for your purposes to look at to figure out how you may want to sample. And one of the things that we really want to emphasize on this slide is that sedimentation does not, open plates, expecting the microbes to fall on them, is not a very good way of assessing the content of the air, because we cannot ascribe a denominator. What volume of air did we sample? We do not have that, and so we cannot determine what the content is, because the sedimentation or open plate method really allows for the gravitational pull to bias the sample, so it is not an ideal way. What we'd like to do on the next slide, we see various pictures of volumetric air samplers. We have high-volume samplers in the slit impactor, as well as the SAS model that allow us to sample a reasonably large volumes of air compared to the standard, which is the Anderson in the lower right, which only samples 1 cubic foot a minute or 0.028 liters per minute, where the other two samplers sample anywhere between 700 liters per minute and 100 liters per minute. So we do need to realize that in hospitals we have highly purified air. So in order to see if we have a problem, we must sample a sufficient amount of air to make that kind of analysis. The next slide has a summary of some of the data that we have collected over the last 40 to 50 years. This is a compilation of approximately, it looks like, 8 years. We have submitted a paper over 10 years of sampling experience, but note the yellow emphasis being two different incubation temperatures, 35C versus 25, approximately one order of magnitude difference in airborne fungi grow at these variations. The higher temperature is selective. However, the pathogens grow at the higher temperature, so we utilize the higher temperature as a means of determining what the pathogen content might be. And as you can see, there is considerable difference between outdoors at these two temperatures, again showing about an order of magnitude difference. But if you look at bone marrow, where we have HEPA filtration, we see additional reductions. And what we see is a rank order from clean to cleanest, with outdoor being not so clean, of course. But yet that clean to cleaner to cleanest ranking allows us to see that we do have the lowest counts in the areas where we have the greatest emphasis through ventilation. And it assures me that we do have control, especially compared to outside. We cannot create a sterile environment. So if the next slide says how we interpret the data, we want that rank order. Lowest counts are in the areas with the best filtration and ventilation, and we need to compare with outdoors. This is logical. We take those samples, again, to demonstrate that we do have significant reduction. Qualitatively, we would like to avoid Aspergillus, especially those pathogens, Fumigatus, Flavus, Terius, and potentially nowadays Niger. We would like to see a heterogeneous population when we sample. That is to say, outside we have all kinds of fungi floating around, but indoors, if we see one kind in reasonable numbers, five or six, let's say, and they all look yellow, the potential for an internal source is greatly increased. Indoor-outdoor ratios, that means to say that you should see lesser numbers inside than outside. We have to be careful if we use this, and this is normally used in areas such as office space or libraries or places where we would expect higher numbers of microbes, but compared to outside, if we're seeing 50, 60, 70, 90% reduction, that should correspond approximately to the filtration efficiency, and we'll talk more about that later. But when the indoor-air-outdoor ratio is greater than one, we have a potential problem, and I'll demonstrate that. Pathogens grow best at 35°C, where we see so many more microbes growing at 25, we certainly can use that to demonstrate the filtration efficacy. And the next slide with the colors, with the exponential difference on the y-axis, we can see those numbers reduced. We use the arithmetic mean. Many of you around the world may use geometric means, and the reason why they use a geometric mean for analysis is because there are outliers, unusually high numbers that they smooth out with the geometric mean. And I'll get back to this because I think that is what we're looking for if we should take the time to look. So what we want to see as we look at this slide from 1999, we see significant reductions in airborne fungi from outside to inside because our filtration and ventilation in the bone marrow ward are superior. And the next slide shows the variation you expect, especially outdoors. On the upper graphic, you see 1 week averages for 18 months. Those 18 months we sampled here in Minnesota, and you see back at that time, as the fall was winding down into the valley of snow, as to come back up in spring, summer, and fall to drop back down again, it's a natural cycle which we would expect. Down below, we see situations where when sampling simultaneously from three locations in our bone marrow unit many years ago, we saw the effects of a 30% efficient filter in the sense that outside affected the indoor corridor because of those inefficient filters, and we saw the numbers rise correspondingly from outside to inside where the HEPA-filtered room stayed flat. What we also see in the slide to the right, where other Aspergillus species, we see conditions in that simultaneous sampling where the patient room and outdoors saw no flavus for extended period of time during that day of sampling. Then at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, we had a spike, significant spike of flavus in the environment. And when we went back to try and figure out why, because this is the first time we'd ever seen that back in the 80s, we found out that the housekeeper had come through and cleaned the tops of the lights in that bone marrow ward, and we caught it as a short-term high-dose exposure potential. This is something we will discuss as we move through. And the next slide was a result of that same sampling period back in those 18 months in the mid-80s, where we saw a sink affect the indoor environment. Now, this can happen at home, in your workplace, or in a patient care area. So what we have here is a sink. That sink got out of control as the relative humidity started to rise outside. Infection control insists that we wash our hands, and the sink that was used in this medication room on our bone marrow ward was not capable of controlling the splashing. The water ran down the sides and created an incredible colony of microbes, fungi. Those fungi proliferated, and in the controlled experiment, which was described in the Journal of Clinical Micro back in 1987, we were able to demonstrate that this sink released 800,000 spores an hour without the orderly digging around for a bedpan. So we do need to realize that these conditions occur from time to time in our built environment, and we need to realize that we need to protect them. The next slide was not staged. This is a construction project in New York City that is an incredible colony of mold. From the looks of it, it could be a whole variety of fungi that could be problematic, and those brooms would be considered fomites. When we disturb a colony, the horizontal diffusion depiction show that we can distribute those spores in the XYZ plane, and it moves throughout. It moves throughout the facility to look for that susceptible host to either cause them to sneeze or potentially to start to grow to proliferate that species of fungi. So whenever we see something like this, our first effort should be to kill it, to destroy it, to either bleach it down or to cover it up with some other kind of material. These are dangerous colonies, and this was in a laboratory setting and could have really presented itself as a problem if it didn't. I was only there for a day demonstrating these potentials. And the next graphic is a result of 600 and some samplings in the 80s where we went out and looked for Aspergillus fumigatus. It's a histogram, and it is colony-forming units per three, almost four cubic meters of air. And if you'll note, the most common number is zero. We do not recover Aspergillus fumigatus from the built environment very often. However, as we move to the right, we find that there are instances where we see high dose exposure potential. What were the cause of those? And when I went back to look to find out what could potentially cause those bursts, we found that they were construction projects changing out our radiology equipment in our radiation therapy department. So we had evidence that we, as we started to rebuild or renovate our environment, were creating these aerosols, these high-dose aerosols, which have been rarely described in the literature. The next slide compares what we saw at the University of Minnesota over roughly 10 years to what the University of Illinois Medical Center in 98 and 99 saw when they looked at their 25 degrees C incubation temperatures. You'll see that the averages in solid organ especially are very similar and not that different when it comes to bone marrow transplant. Outside levels are quite different in Minnesota versus Chicago, maybe for because Chicago's in the middle of the city and we don't have that big a city to compare. But what we really want you to notice are the extremes, the range. Commonly, a statistician will throw out the extremes or convert to geometric means. I think these numbers are the most important because I feel because of the snapshot versions of sampling that we do, that we want to protect for when we disturb the environment to create these high levels. That's why I say sampling does not control infections. Paying attention to the detail as to what events, such as the mold colony I showed you a few minutes ago, what the effects those disruptions would be on the local environment. And by the time you find it, unfortunately, it's too late. So what we've seen in over 1,200 samplings in the next slide is a definition of burst. We defined a burst as three standard deviations above the mean. And out of 1,200 and some samplings, we only found 48 that were higher than three standard deviations. Is it worth it to sample to find these and then react to them? You can't react fast enough. The exposure has already occurred after you've done the sampling. So why, when someone walks in the building coughing, we want to contain the cough. When someone's going to do maintenance on that sink that's been leaking for the last 2 years, we want to make sure that that sink is well managed when that repair occurs, and it takes the workman to understand the value of that effort. So here is an example of very few times when we've seen a problem over all that time, and quite honestly, there was nothing we did with any of these burst indications other than go look a couple of times to find out what the potential problem really was. And in the next slide, you see examples of mold growing under a sink because it was leaky, and the flap from the vinyl. We don't like vinyl where there's moisture on the other side. We see a mold growing prolifically in a children's hospital in the southeastern part of the United States. And on the bottom, we see the result of a steam valve failure in a mechanical space where the flasher sterilizer was located in an operating room. To be real here, there was orthopedic surgery going on the other side of that wall. Is this a problem? You might say so. However, I think from my experience that spaces where there's heat have good exhaust ventilation. So we were pulling with the exhaust these spores out of the room. But note very carefully on the left side of that slide that there's a mark approximately maybe a foot or two long, that might mean somebody went in and touched that colony to wonder what it was. That individual becomes a vector. He walks or she walks throughout that facility, potentially shedding spores for those to breathe that might have a response. So what we're saying here is pay attention. When you find it, think, find, get help, and move forward. I'm going to talk about some other types of slides before I get back, other types of sampling methods before I get back. The next slide depicts a cassette sampling methodology that is the most common these days in sampling for fungi. It takes air through a cassette apparatus that's connected to a pump, as you see in the upper right-hand corner. It pulls air through. It smacks the spores represented by the graphic on the lower right. It smacks spores onto a sticky surface that can be used to visualize the morphology of those spores for identification. However, we do not know the difference between little round spores. We can't tell the difference between Geocladium on the next slide, Aspergillus, or Penicillium. They're little, they're round, they're difficult to distinguish, even though the morphology in one case for Penicillium has a paintbrush like morphology, where the other has a round ball depicting the Aspergilli, for which it was named after. So we do need to be careful what methods we use to sample. This visual analysis is faster. It can be used in certain clearance, but it should not be used for final commissioning on highly sensitive wards such as bone marrow transplant, operating rooms, or even neonatal ICUs. The next slide shows a very handy method of sampling when you can find the fungi, the fungal colony. This was taken from aquarium. Don't put aquariums in clinical spaces. In aquariums that we found that had a water leak. Water leaks are not acceptable, and paper towels or washcloths are not a good way to collect the water because it creates conditions like you see. However, if you take a piece of Scotch tape and you put it on that surface, clear plastic tape, and you then put it onto a slide, you can take this back to the laboratory for rapid identification. This method is also very good for looking at surfaces. We've used methods using high-volume samplers to look behind walls when we've had water leaks, and you can see a very distinct difference between outside and indoor wall cavity versus indoor air samples. We had a huge water leak, which we wrote up as a case study, published elsewhere, where we utilized this method and was very useful in helping us find where the most water damage was in our first in actually my first big, huge water leak that occurred many years ago. The next slide looks at some non-viable sampling, which includes utilizing a particle counter. Biological safety cabinets, where we utilize this device most often. It's commonly used in the International Standards Organization to validate ventilation requirements, especially in areas such as clean rooms. It is now being ascribed for usage in the United States under the United States Pharmacopeia 797 rulings to validate filters and to make sure that we do have the appropriate ventilation control. We focus on the 0.5 micron size particle. We do not focus on the 0.3 because it is the most difficult to capture, and we want to be able to utilize a one that's more realistic, that demonstrates better ventilation removal, especially when it comes to filtration. And these devices, now that they become handheld, are quite handy in accomplishing that task. If we look at the next slide, where we've looked at various particle sizes, and there are a couple of particle counters that we can use. One is an optical particle counter like the one you previously saw, and another one is a condensation particle counter, which uses very small particles, 0.02 to 1 micron in size, and that particular particle size or range is also very effectively removed by filters. Filter theory is a two-tailed curve, and I wish I had more time to discuss that with you as part of filter theory, but take it from me, the small particles serve a good surrogate, as do the larger particles. It's just the 0.3 micron size particle is difficult to capture. But if we look at this particular graphic or table, we see that the outside is quite different from the lobby, is quite different from the bone marrow area corridor. Particle counts are extremely reduced. We've got good pressure differentials on 21 out of 32 rooms, actually on all the rooms, and we've got high-efficiency HEPA filtration at 99.97. But 21 out of those 32 rooms had very low counts. 9 out of the 32 had modest counts, where there was some activity in the room, people riding bikes, making beds, that sort of thing. But 2 out of those 32 rooms had very, very high numbers. One of them was due to the fact that there was a medicated aerosol going on. Recently, I've saw medicated aerosols going far beyond this level as they were administering albuterol to some patients in our bone marrow ward, which I picked up with the particle counter. And there, those particles come out. The other particle reading was 17,000. Was somebody in there cleaning a mirror, taking a shower where droplets were floating around? I don't know. But within 20 minutes, the counts were back down to 30. So we certainly saw the ventilation efficacy utilizing the particle counter where we had a high level that dropped very rapidly. We do not want to react to particle counts with one single sample. We want to repeat the samples with a particle counter several times to see if these are transient high-dose exposures. We don't know what those particles are. They could be a water droplet, or they could be something out of the Windex, pardon the brand name, some kind of window cleaning product that generates an aerosol. So we go back and sample again to see how long that aerosol stays. And as you can see, the diffusers were working very well, as was the case of a comparison to other areas, demonstrating again that the cleanest environment was in the area where we had the greatest effort. So as we look at those essential surveillance parameters, the infection control prevention comes with the ventilation, not with the air sampling, and this is borne out by the air changes per hour, and you can see in that environmental infection control guideline that there is a rate of decay. For example, you want 99% reduction in particles with 12 air changes an hour. That will take about 20 minutes. So, again, there is an exchange rate associated with particle reduction. And if we look at pressure control, we can see, too, that air velocity is what we're really measuring, especially when we control those rooms. And the air velocity, when you have 0.25 pascals, is 0.61 or 120, roughly, feet per minute, meters per second. And as you can see, the higher we go, the faster the air moves. We do not want to get up around 25 pascals because we start to create wind whistle, somewhere around 1,000 feet per minute. I can't convert that fast, sorry. But at a tenth of an inch, which is equal to 25 pascals, we certainly would be creating wind whistle, and that nuisance is very difficult to deal with. We want to have minimal leakage. That's subject for a completely different talk, but yet in the United States, we do not have a standard for leakage. We are working on one. I will provide a definition shortly for one, but for now we're looking at around 2.5 square inches of leakage per 100 square feet of surface area within a room. So we want to get to that, and it's how do we get there, and that is a subject of a different presentation. Filtration supply for protective environment rooms and exhaust from the AII rooms should have some filtration depending on where it's discharged or where it's going. In the case of the patient, we certainly, again, have looked at some of the parameters which we have discussed previously. What I have the greatest concern on the next slide is that in these United States and Canada and all over the world where I've checked, filters are not properly installed and maintained. The filter bank you are looking at on the next slide was the result of the filters getting wet and blowing out. I have seen this in Canada. I've seen this on the west coast of the United States. This particular fan system was in Pennsylvania. And what we're advocating is an in-situ test for filter efficacy. Do the filters work? And in the risk assessments that I perform around the country, this is one of the first things we do to make sure that when the condition of construction begins, that we manage to make sure that the filters are properly installed. That's your liability. That's your responsibility as an owner and as an infection control person. We have to make sure our filters are properly maintained. And in the next slide, you'll see a representation of how we would interpret that data. With this particular particle counter, an optical particle counter, we're seeing greater than 99% reduction before and after filtration. And this is a risk assessment we did a few months ago in Chicago while we were doing that process. So again, it's a way of interpreting the data that validates in the next slide that a particular patient room is working when you're establishing baseline before moving in. And you can see that we have little or no particles coming out from underneath the room of the door. We've got 13 pascals pressure, and Dawn on the next slide is actually doing a filter check to make sure that the filters are appropriately installed and we do not get leakage. The next slide demonstrates some surface sample methodologies, and we certainly are familiar with how we would swab. Swabbing is difficult to quantitate. It is something, again, that we need a template. What are the standards? What should we see? It's a little more difficult to work with, but yet it does give us some information. When we look at the CDC guidelines on the next slide, we certainly need to think about all of these considerations, the method of sampling, the number of replicate samples, the parameters of the sample assay. Again, it becomes more complicated and not as easy to do. And if we look again at the next slide, which comes from the Environmental Infection Control Guidelines on surface sampling, we see again a variety of methodologies. And some of these are described in the American Society for Microbiology Clinical Procedures Manual, which was written in 2004. And I have a chapter in there as well as others who talk about how we would sample various devices and will be useful if you've got an issue perhaps with an endoscope or even on some surfaces. And one of the ways that I like to sample surfaces is in the last row, which is actually using the Rodak plate or the surface contact media plate. Again, very, very useful, and there is a standard associated with it. Here you see the Rodak plate from carpet cleaning. It's amazing what the carpet extractor puts down. If you want to talk about carpet being dirty, this is a good example of how it gets dirty. Before we brought the extractor in, very little microbes on the surface. Immediately after extraction and 1 hour after, there was a lingering effect of that dirty water that gets sprayed down in that particular device. So when you think about carpeting, it's not the carpet that's the problem. It's the carpet cleaning equipment and the removal of the carpet that becomes the problem. So other methods that are being utilized, we've used polymerase chain reaction. It's a method that worked quite well in a project in Hawaii for cleaning up mold contamination. You can get rapid turnaround. It's extremely sensitive. We can do both surface and air samples. They give it out as a surface equivalent per unit volume. We really need to make sure that we sample ahead of time so we know what the predominant microorganisms are. In this case, we identified the Aspergillus, and we knew what Aspergillus to look for as far as their proteins and DNA equivalents. Interpretation of the guidelines needs to be done ahead of time. For example, we want, if the air sample was negative and the surface was positive, we want to clean and move on. Or if both the surface and the air was dirty, we want to sanitize and resample as a means. Another way that we do rapid sampling is utilizing ATP. Adenine triphosphate is our energy source, our renewable energy source that we have in our bodies. All living cells that have mitochondria produce ATP for energy. We can find what kind of environmental load is on a surface very quickly, because if we take a bioluminescent material called luciferase, bind it to the ATP in living cells, we can get a relative difference in levels of environmental contamination. It's a surrogate determination of environmental cleaning, and it should determine surface cleanliness. In fact, it is used in HACCP analysis by United States, Department of Agriculture, to look at the cleaning processes in our food manufacturing in the United States, and it's commonly used in the UK, and we're doing some clinical trials now to look and see if it can be used, actually environmental trials, where it can be utilized to see if we have a correlation between the colony-forming units on the surface or in water and what we get for a relative light unit determination. So again, we're looking at some interpretation guidelines, less than 100, okay, 100 to 1,000 relative light units about should look at it and clean it, and then we really have some problems when it starts getting real high. And I utilized this method when in some mold that I found in a reading room where this device was pegged out at 99.99 when we swabbed it, combined the luciferase, very simple test, very inexpensive. A number of models out there, which one works best for you needs to be determined. But we were able to show that with simple cleaning, we can very rapidly remove the amount of biological contamination in that space. This would be very helpful for us when the sewers back up. It happens in my institution. I bet you it happens in yours, too. But when that happens, how do you know that they cleaned it properly? This would be a rapid way with which we could evaluate that situation, and as was the case in the next slide where we had a leaky ice maker with a failed plastic component. Why don't we like plastic? Because it breaks. Metal doesn't. So we can see that this fuzzy spot on the left had 3,100 relative light units, whereas a comparable piece of gypsum board right next to it had very few. So we can know for a fact that we have something living and we need to deal with it appropriately, either by encapsulating it or cutting it out. As I stated, all buildings leak. This occurred some months ago when, on the next slide, Manny there is standing on, put his foot on a stool in our ICU. This is actually a hopper that we use to flush down emesis and bedpan contents. But unfortunately, somebody flushed some kind of a cloth down, and it got caught in a clean out, and the guys were upstairs testing a waterproof floor, and when they pulled the plug to let the water go, it hit that clean out full of some cloth, a rag, if you will, a T-shirt, whatever. It backed up and came out in our intensive care unit. The ATP would have been extremely helpful here. We didn't have it yet, in determining whether or not we cleaned up. Again, very important to do that. This next slide of the aquarium was a result of caused 5 cases of aspergillosis, surface contact aspergillosis in burn patients that I discovered last year. Visually, this is not a good idea. It's not a good idea to put aquariums into critical clinical space, any clinical space in my mind, because in this case, even though it was well-maintained, they had to put a fan in to cool the water because of the lights. That left a that fan accumulated dust, and if you look very carefully underneath the fan, you'll see some blue-green material, and that's where the mold was growing, on the food. It contaminated, it grew, it contaminated the air. The air got out into the burn ward, and the patients that were directly adjacent to the area where this aquarium was developed aspergillosis. So we really need to be aware of mold, where it can grow, and how to realize how to deal with it. We need to recognize fungal potential, and the outward signs, such as colonies on the wall, should be a flash. Be careful when you see that. If it smells, your intuition should tell you there's mold growing somewhere, regardless if in the fan coil or potentially in other space, and it's a result usually of water damage or water that doesn't drain. The control methods are in containment, cleanup, and verification, and those are very important. And we use a variety of devices to try and sample for that. Particle counters, pressure gauge, the air sample is in real time, but we really want to start looking at are these moisture meters, because if we can cut off the moisture to these microorganisms, we can prevent their growth from producing spores, which then migrate. We use these same kinds of devices to look at particles released during photocopiers in a photocopier environment. The data here with this data logger shows the rise and fall during active copying. Again, we try to isolate our copying machines in areas that are not occupied but have exhaust systems that will pull it out. Nothing elaborate, but yet we want to get those particles away. Likewise, we use additional equipment in this Q-track. The Q-track here measures carbon dioxide, relative humidity, and temperature, and we often can find ventilation deficiencies using CO2 and temperature and relative humidity as it forms spikes during the occupied part of the day. It's very fascinating to use this, and in the next slide, we can see some data logging information where we looked at CO2, carbon monoxide, temperature, and relative humidity. We like to monitor over a period of days in order to see what happens on weekends. As activity goes down, so do the levels of carbon dioxide and the relative humidity, and we can actually see, if you look closely, at some of those about lunchtime when people leave the office. So this helps us a lot, especially when doing indoor air quality investigations, which some of you might get involved with. It's not all particles, it's not all fungi, but in this case, we look to see what kind of ventilation might be going on in that space based on these ventilation parameters that are used to detect when things get uncomfortable. The toolkit we've talked about here today covers a lot of air samplers, the optical versus condensation. We could spend more time with that. We certainly want to use pressure gauges. The trick is, what is the sensitivity? We want at least a thousandth of an inch or a 0.25 pascals to make sure that it's sensitive enough to look at the hundredth of an inch or 2.5 pascals pressure differential that we in the States look to as a controlling pressure. Moisture monitors, again, it's very useful to have something that you can detect moisture. We're going to get into that more momentarily, as well as the air samplers, which do not really give you real-time analysis, but can be useful, especially as you're validating the environment before you occupy or looking for that epidemiological evidence that may be the cause of infections in your facility. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about water. You see a list of water. You see also in the next slide a compilation of of reservoirs and what problems they cause, again, from the environmental infection control guidelines. And as we go to the next slide with a depiction of dialysis water from an old slide that I made, because dialysis is where I got my hospital beginnings, we see that it's a complex system, and that because we take the carbon out, we have lots of opportunity to grow mold, because we've gotten rid of our residual chlorine that's commonly used in municipal water systems to control microbes. So we see a lot of potential in a dialysis water treatment systems. And in fact, when we look at how we manage, in the next slide, we have a lot of things to consider. I know of hospitals that have contaminated their piping system, and they have not been able to get rid of the microbes that develop the biofilm. So how you bring these devices online is very important. Once you fill them with water, they have to work. They have to move water, and even if it means throwing it away, you should continually move water for a better part of a day and not go more than a couple of days without utilizing the water. In addition to that, you should have water disinfection in the form of ultraviolet lighting and sample ports in order to keep track of what's going on. In the States, this is our only real environmental requirement, and that comes in the next slide. Again, 2,000 colony-forming units per mil in the makeup water, and 200 colony-forming units in the makeup water, and 2,000 colony-forming units coming from the dialyzer. And so this is something, again, that we have to react to and in our dialysis unit, because we get a tremendous amount of funding to take care of these patients, which are on a government-funded program here in the States. And they have, some folks in the CDC have said we should even respond to something as low as 50 colony-forming units. This has proven to be a real problem, and we're in discussion with them that this is unrealistically low. And with the fact that if you take your equipment out of service, what does that do to patient care and patient safety? Very little of patient safety. You know good and well that those microbes, if they're in the water, can be transmitted by our hands much more readily, and we must practice that good technique in an effort to keep those environmental microbes from reaching the patients through the vector process, or the vector process, which is us. So again, hand washing is very important. We see infections associated in the next slide with hydrotherapy equipment. How we disinfect becomes very important, as is the case with microorganisms and their sources in ice machines. I've worked on serratia coming from ice machines, and certainly that was a problem in a local hospital. And if we look even further in the next slide, one of the issues are so-called emerging infectious diseases, which I just got an email on yesterday, has to do with these atypical mycobacteria. These atypical mycobacteria are resistant to chlorine. They're commonly found in water. And in the next slide, in a paper we published in Infection Control Hospital Epidemiology a couple of years ago, you can see the epidemiological curve of this mucogenicum, Mycobacterium mucogenicum, as it was found in some of our patients. And the interesting thing on the next slide, you can read the article for yourself. The lead author here is Susan Klein. If you look at the next slide where we have looked at chlorine levels in our municipal water system that are taken by the city, we see very stable levels of chlorine, chloramine, I should say, combined chlorine, 4 parts per million, which went away for some reason in August. When it went away, we had 5 cases of Mycobacterium mucogenicum septis in our bone marrow transplant patients. This is truly cause and effect, where an environmental disinfectant in our water went away and created problems in our patients. We wonder how often this happens when those weird stenotrophomonas or buccal areas show up. Is it a cause due to the fact that our chlorine goes away, or is it some other factor? And when we go back to find out where these microbes come from, we rarely can find the source. So again, a little hint to look to your municipal water system, and in the fact that in this particular situation, we found that it was our showers that created the problem, and with the fact that we utilize a tremendous number of showers with dependent loops so that the patient can sit on a chair and rinse themselves off and not take nursing time, it becomes important patient care item. And if you see on that slide that there's considerably different numbers in the microbes that we recover from the shower versus the other side of the wall where we had a sink. Again, the tubing develops a biofilm, and this was in our bone marrow patients. They didn't rinse it out well enough. They didn't let it dangle to drain, and it created a problem of getting into the three-way stopcocks on the IVs as well as the Hickman access causing infections. And on the next slide, you'll see the culprit. Pay attention, please, to the washer on the right, lower right. That is pure biofilm that repeatedly seeded these tubes whenever they sat stagnant. We now dangle the tubes. We do not allow them to be hooked up. Again, we were looking to change out these washers. They're made out of cellulose, which is excellent growth material for the microbes. So this biofilm is truly a problem for us, as is the case potentially in a lot of your facilities. And when you look at the weird organisms, Stenotropha moldus, Burkholderia, area, or even the atypical mycobacteria, I often advise people to look at these showers and these washers. It's not the aerator that's the problem. It's the washer that's the problem, or the O-ring, or whatever you want to call it. We have a number of devices in our hospitals that are inappropriately used. The case of the water pick on the left was used to clean out endoscopes that caused problems. In the case of the blood warmer on the right, wonderful device. You know how wonderful these devices are in saving blood. It's the reservoir of water that's used that can become a problem associated with a variety of gram-negative microbes. And when your anesthesia aides who fill these think it's sterile water and then get water on their fingertips, it's a sad mistake, and we do need to teach them to disconnect the patient first before we disconnect the water, because that way we avoid the water contamination. We can't get rid of the reservoir in all cases, but we do need to be able to manage how we control its spread. Cooking equipment, or in this case, we found huge numbers of microbes affecting our short bowel kids because these devices could not be taken apart and disinfected properly. And when you start to see foodborne problems in some patients, especially in infants, we look to this kind of thing, and we've resolved this by autoclaving our parts rather than trying to disinfect them. Legionella, going rapidly through that, can be found in a variety of places. Prevention and control, again, coming from the CDC guidelines, means either sampling the water or sampling the patient. What we tend to do is sample the patient and then look for the sources in water, and we certainly want to maintain our water system without dead-end connections, because that's where that stagnant water starts to build up, as you see from this depiction of a water system. We continually discontinue sinks and a variety of other items in our facilities, and that dead-end connection then grows bacteria in the Venturi effect without the residual chlorine, allows those microbes to potentially get to patients. And when we look at chlorination in the next slide, we see that chloramines are becoming more popular. The fact that in some instances where we've seen infectious outbreaks of Legionella, 73% of those hospitals have transplant programs. And this is work done by Jacob Kuhl some years ago. It can be found in the literature as well as environmental infection control. And 31 outbreaks were associated with free available chlorine versus the monochloramine. We also utilize chlorine dioxide as a means to disinfect our water systems, and that is pretty replete in the literature. You can find a lot of information on that. But what we're beginning to see, as depicted by an April 2006 Emerging Infectious Disease article, is that in San Francisco, where we had 53 buildings that they tested with Legionella in it, that simply by adding the chloramine to the water, which San Francisco did a few years ago, they vastly reduced the amount of Legionella in those buildings. So widespread use of chloramines may reduce Legionellosis and transmission of disease throughout the world, but unfortunately a lot of people don't use chloramine because their paranoia for that is also associated with infections. As we, or problems, I should say. when we look at the next slide with the cooling towers, anytime we do a construction project around the towers, you have to look at your oxidant. You have to do a look at your towers more closely, because that bio load or that load of oxidant chlorine demand or bromine demand items that come from dirt may put your tower into susceptibility for growing more Legionella, because the disinfectant is not there. And it's very important, again, with cooling towers to deal with how you disinfect them, as you see with our pumps that are used to disinfect the towers. It's very important. Verification of ventilation in our pharmacy standard, again, follows. We feel that people should follow the clean, cleaner, cleanest. The cleanest environment is where we manufacture our chemotherapeutic agents as well as our antibiotics or any IV material. And we certainly want to make sure that in the next slide, where you can see I'm sampling not only with particles but with the pressure gauge, that manufacturing area. And we do have problems because we put the cabinets in the background that were not properly gasketed, and we're working to fix that now. So certainly we can do these sorts of things with particle analysis, and that comparison is really what I want you to come away with whenever we look at any kind of environmental issue. We want to compare it to other areas so that we can make sure that we have the appropriate ventilation control. Air sampling helps, but managing your ventilation systems and managing your environment so that it's clean is truly the way that we prevent infections. And the cleanliness verification should be demonstrated in hands, in air quality, on surfaces, and, of course, if we can get our people to be trained, we understand and we can develop competencies for that effort. Boy, did I talk fast. But with that, I've pretty much finished my presentation. I wish I could take some questions. I don't know if you have allowance to do that, Sharon. But I hope this has been useful for you in better understanding how to sample. And if those of you want to ask further questions, my email address is on the first slide, and you're welcome to send me an email. Try not to call me, because I'm very bad about that, but I'm a lot better about my email. So thank you very much for the opportunity to speak.
Thanks, Andy. I think this was a wonderful presentation, and I'm sure the rest of the audience thought so, too. A lot of it's rather technical, so I'll have to look it over a few times. But just as a reminder, you can either email Andy or email me. It's down as Sharon@WeberTraining.com. And Paul will be back, to handle some of these things.